When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
A friend recently asked me why I'm a political junkie. What is it about politics, he wanted to know, that drew my interest and had me following it the way most people would probably follow sports or their favorite genre of music, or I don't know what other examples there might be out there. It's always been politics for me. He, in this conversation, said, I asked him, I said, is it really any different than your interest in the NBA, which is, I mean, honestly, if you're going to follow a sport, probably the worst choice, in my opinion. But that aside, I said, is it really any different than that? And he said, well, the NBA, following sports in general as a sports junkie, is it's fun and it's interesting and it has real life connection potential. You make friends. And I countered that in politics, the same thing exists. In fact, in politics, there's a lot of crossover behavior. There's not a lot of crossover between political junkies and sports junkies. Some, but not a lot in my experience. But there is a lot of crossover behavior. There are very unreasonable fanatics. There are people who will stick by their favorite team regardless of what the reality of the upcoming season or even the season that just wrapped tells you about the quality or skill of that team. You see the same thing in politics. So right now out there all around America, there are Democrats adopting a favorite candidate in May of 2019 without for a second realizing this is probably not the smartest thing to do. If you have a favorite candidate right now, someone that you think is the only one that can beat Donald Trump and do what's best for the country, well, most likely, before all is said and done, you're going to be either embarrassed for that early adoption, or you're going to be saying some really stupid things on the internet to justify it and defend the early adoption. No, don't pick a favorite candidate, in my opinion. Right now, Democrats should be picking their least favorite. And if you're curious who is on my list right now for least favorite, currently and probably permanently, Tulsi Gabbard. Cory Booker, not high on my list with all of his trying to recreate the Obama 2008 campaign here in the Trump era. Not my favorite of the candidates. There are a few others, but I digress. The reason this conversation came up, we were actually talking about what's important in life as far as what you spend your time on. And I was defending people who find a lot of time for pop culture or even the Kardashians. I don't know. Are they still a thing? I'm out of touch on that side of American life. But still, I defend people who find time for that type of thing because I think distraction is important. I think just the fun of pop culture and entertainment shouldn't be dismissed. Not everything can be serious. But on the counter side of that, I think that too many people, almost like that obnoxious contrarian libertarian guy that everybody went to high school or college with that just it was there because he thought that made him unique. I think too many people pride themselves on a statement like, I'm apolitical or I'm not a political person. I don't have time to be that involved. Yeah, I vote sometimes, but I don't think that's something to pride yourself on. And I think it actually speaks to the failure of both major political parties that arguably the majority of eligible voters out there probably fall into a category where more often than not, they would say something like, I'm not a very political person. The reason that bothers me is that it's not ever true. Politics is everything. And I'm not saying politics is everything in the extent that I can't believe every other American is not like me when it comes to politics or like you who would listen to this podcast or The Left Show or anything in a similar vein. I'm not saying everyone out there should be like that. I'm not saying everyone out there should be a political junkie. I'm not saying everyone out there should know the minutiae and trivia and history that I could rattle off about Congress or the presidency. It's no more important, I have to admit, than knowing the history of your favorite college basketball team or the NCAA at large. So I don't think there is, not that there's anything wrong with that, knowing the history of your favorite college basketball team. But the point I'm trying to make is that I think a lot of times political junkies feel that what they're doing is more important. And sports junkies, I think, feel that what they're spending their time on is a better use of their time. That's human nature. That's human behavior. But I do think that the fact that so many Americans proudly describe themselves as not very political speaks to how poorly the major parties have done in a generation of communicating the importance of public policy and the importance of what the parties generally stand for. And their candidates, I think, have played a big part in that, too. Now, some of that has a lot to do with the media and the medium that connects American voters or potential voters to political candidates and campaigns and parties. There are limitations there. We've all grown up in an era where everyone was bemoaning the potential harm of the 30-second soundbite news media culture. Well, yeah, welcome to today when 30 seconds seems like a long time compared to what's getting out there. If you've ever followed The Hill on Twitter and their headlines, knowing that few people are actually clicking on the link, they're just seeing the headline and being informed that way. Man, what I'd give for a 30-second soundbite cycle to return. Again, I digress. The point I'm trying to make here is that not everyone can be a political junkie. Not everyone should be a political junkie. Not everyone is going to find it worth their time to pay attention to politics the way they might their favorite college basketball team or their favorite franchise at large. Maybe you're an NHL fan, NBA fan, NFL fan. That's going to seem far more worth the average person's time because it's entertaining and because they can do this as a community. And I think that's where modern political parties and candidates have failed in general for a generation now to communicate the importance of public policy, to make a community around politics in general. And I think if you really wanted to start splitting hairs, you could find fingers of this failure growing out into everything from low voter turnout, obviously, to people voting against their own best interests because of a couple of very memorable and oftentimes superficial Ponzi scheme like positions of a party or a candidate. A Ponzi scheme in that it's a position the candidate will stake out. It's not something they're ever going to achieve or even really try that hard to achieve, but it gets your attention and maybe even gets a donation and a vote. A lot of times that's how I think the majority of Americans are interacting with political parties and political candidates. And so to go back several decades to the mid to late 1960s, you had this growing movement coming off of the heyday, if you will, of political movements, the civil rights era, still there, still vibrant and still a lot of work to be done. And if you read the history books, what you'll read about is a lot of fragmentation. You'll hear that overreach is another term you might hear. You'll read about this supposed response from the majority of Americans that got tired of what I oftentimes hear political scientists call sort of a grievance culture. that had erupted around movement politics, around civil rights, and then the perceived fragmentation. I say perceived because I don't think it really was fragmented at all. But the perceived fragmentation that you had, the civil rights movement breaking off into the growing power of feminist movements, and specifically, even in the feminist movement, a fragmentation there was perceived between white women and black women, for example. It's remembered and oftentimes viewed as a fragmentation that was a result of success on some levels in these movements. Then the movement's not just stepping back and saying, okay, job done. And the idea for a long time was that Americans tired of this, even if they were sympathetic or at least not outright opposed to the women folk and the black folk getting their due here and there. White people in general, conventional wisdom went, got tired of it. They grew wary of this grievance that they were constantly hearing about, and then they rejected it. In hindsight, I can understand how political scientists of the day saw it like that, but in hindsight, that was not at all what was happening. What was happening, really, was a failure of communication, which is something that brings us right up to today and talk of impeachment for the Democrats. The messages certain candidates are crafting together, trying to see what sticks as they mount their respective runs against Donald Trump in 2020, and the state of the Democratic Party at large for a good couple of decades, if not three. So back to the 1960s, there's this amazing and to be honest with you, hard to really grasp fully this far on. But if you know a bit about the politics and the public policy debates of the time that were happening in 1969, it helps to understand a great essay by a feminist, well-known feminist writer and activist named Carol Hanisch. And she wrote an essay that is commonly known. It was actually published originally as Notes from the Second Year, Women's Liberation. It was published in 1970. That was her official title, but it became known inside the movement and even inside the media as The Personal is Political. That was the working title, if you will. Now, Carol Hanisch always rejected that title, and it was also oftentimes expressed as The Private is Political inside this feminist movement that was really gaining steam, but at the time appeared outwardly as if it was lacking a direction, something specific to ask for or demand. That wasn't the case, of course. It was more the politics of the time. But also, as Hanisch writes, it was somewhat a failure of communication. My words, not hers. Read the essay to really get a grasp of what she was saying at the time. But it's remembered as a very important essay because it also served as an anchor for a transition that began to take shape inside the feminist movement here in America and then eventually internationally. And she writes in the final paragraph of The Personal is Political, Hanisch writes, "I think we must listen to what so-called apolitical women have to say, not so we can do a better job of organizing them, but because together we are a mass movement." She's saying basically whether a person describes themselves as apolitical or not political doesn't really matter. They are going to live their lives and they're going to make decisions that in one way or another inside of this movement are going to become political. And that can be everything from brands they choose to buy or even stores they choose to shop at to what they choose to watch or read. Hanisch argues that everything can be boiled down, whether the actor at the center of the observation is aware of it or not. Everything, if you keep peeling back layers, eventually comes down to a political thing. What she's saying is that you cannot separate public policy from life because government has a lot of power to dictate many aspects of your life. So it's impossible for a person who might describe themselves as not political to not run up against something political on a pretty frequent basis. So what Hanisch is writing about, she says, I think we who work full time in the movement, she's speaking again of the feminist movement in the late 60s, and this is heading into the early 70s when things really started to take shape. She said, I think we who work full time in the movement tend to become very narrow. What is happening now is that when non-movement women disagree with us, we assume it's because they are apolitical, not because there might be something wrong with our thinking. Women have left the movement in droves. The obvious reasons are that we are tired of being sex slaves and doing shit work for men whose hypocrisy is so blatant in their political stance of liberation for everyone else. But there is really a lot more to it than that. I can't quite articulate it yet. I think apolitical women are not in the movement for very good reasons. And as long as we say you have to think like us and live like us to join the charm circle, we will fail. What Hanisch is writing about is not what Cory Booker is currently attempting to do. She's not talking about some sort of kumbaya let's as here, translating this into a this current political period example. She's not saying let's, like Democrats today, chase after Trump voters and find common ground. That's Cory Booker's obsession right now. She's not saying let's soften our message and stop making the demands we're making and make maybe more incremental, smaller demands. She's not saying any of that. What Hanisch is saying, and I think what got misinterpreted a lot at the time when this essay first was published and got all the eyeballs it got, it was interpreted at the time as saying, yeah, slow things down. You're getting pretty demanding, ladies. But what she's saying, what Hanisch is saying, and is easy to see now this far on from the time, what she's saying is that, hey, we're responding to women who don't want to dedicate their time or their interest or their even their money to this movement. We're responding to them by saying, well, you don't think like us. You don't realize how important this is. And so you're not an ally. Hanisch is writing that that's how the response read or was heard by a lot of people. And it did serve as a sort of a wall between, quote unquote, apolitical or not political women and movement women, women who were very active in the movement. And what Hanisch is saying and what she goes on to write about in the essay is that it's a matter of communicating the importance of what's happening. She says at one point, writes at one point, maybe there's something wrong with the action or something wrong with why we are doing the action, or maybe the analysis of why the action is necessary, that's not clear enough in our own minds. So to put that another way, maybe we as a movement aren't clear enough about why we're doing what we're doing in the first place to be able to articulate it well to those that might describe themselves as not very political. In hindsight, that was the case. And once the movement did find more definition internally, it was able to articulate, for the most part, the importance of the action, whatever it might be, in a way that, well, hearts and minds were one. And I think there's a real lesson in that for right now, but also the Democratic Party of the last couple, maybe three decades. Democrats are the party of responding to public opinion polling. They aren't the party of changing public opinion. They'll talk a good game about changing public opinion, but when it really comes down to the wire for a specific decision or a vote that's going to take place, Democrats seem to default to this, well, here's what the polls are saying, and so I'm going to adjust accordingly. Now, obviously, polls can be wrong. Obviously, looking at one single poll, you're going to be wrong. But Democrats have a tendency to read accurately, I think, the weather vane of public opinion and smartly assess where the public is at on a certain issue, far more than Republicans are capable of. But then what Democrats do that Republicans don't, and this is the real irony of it. You got Republicans over here that basically have no clue what's going on, or half the time are actually convinced that the polls are all wrong and that the public really sides with them. And then they end up winning on accident because oftentimes the public does support them. Even if they don't agree with them, they do support them because Democrats are sitting over here, you know, twisting their hair, and Republicans are like, we're going to get shit done. It might be stupid. It might be something that you don't agree with, but we're not going to just sit on our hands. And I think a lot of times voters respond to that, at least in the sense that they will oftentimes feel Republicans are best prepared to handle a potential crisis or an unknown because of that appearance of activity. Now, the last several years have hurt Republicans in that respect, mainly because they pinned all of their activity on repealing and or replacing Obamacare, and then they were never smart enough to have the replace part taken care of. And there's a reason for that. There really isn't a better replacement. Obamacare was the lowest hanging fruit of health care reform, and Republicans couldn't change that reality, even though they really, really tried. So pinning all their hopes on that sort of took that mystique from them that, yeah, they might be idiots. They might be complete buffoons, but they're not going to just sit there and let everything stay the same. That benefited Republicans for a long time. Democrats need to learn from that example, especially because Democrats do have this tendency to more accurately gauge where the public is at, giving them an advantage if they actually tried for the first time in a generation to change public opinion. Don't just look at the polls and say, well, that's where they're at and we must fall in line. Look at the polls and say, much like Hanisch is writing about when it comes to these internal questions facing the feminist movement in the late 60s, where do we go from here? Consider for a second, as Hanisch wrote, maybe it's not a matter of responding to the people who were at the time criticizing internally the feminist movement, to people who had started to adopt the mentality being pushed on the movement by old white men that they were asking too much and trying to go too far too soon. Women were starting to buy into that, and it was starting to bubble up within the feminist movement. That's what Hanisch is responding to in her essay, somewhat. She's responding to a lot of things. So Hanisch concludes that one thing that they should try first before folding on the big asks or the big steps is maybe seeing if they could do a better job of communicating the importance of those big asks and big steps that needed to be taken. And it worked. This isn't what you're seeing from Democrats right now. Now, obviously, the easiest example I can point to, and in ways the most complex, is impeachment. Democrats right now, at least on the surface, from what we can see, I still think there is a little bit of theater behind this. I think I said this last week. There's still a chance that Pelosi, for example, is taking this position of being very hesitant, if not outright against, beginning an impeachment inquiry, because then she can look like, after Mueller testifies or McGahn testifies, then she can look like, well, something was learned here. I was opposed, but we just learned something that totally changed my mind. Now it's full steam ahead with impeachment inquiry. And that could actually be really smart politics for Democrats in the House. So I'm willing to at least entertain the idea that might be what's up here. But I am concerned that when it comes to impeachment proceedings, Democrats are about to be blindsided, as I've argued several times now, by being forced into a position where they've got to decide yes or no, and they wimp out and decide no because, well, right now it looks like impeachment would be very unpopular among the general electorate. And I don't think Democrats are prepared to try to change that narrative, to, instead of accepting where public opinion is at on a thing, trying to make the case, not just by explaining the nuts and bolts, but by actually selling it to American voters' guts, explaining to them with strong conviction that this needs to happen, and here's why. And when the pundits start clutching at their pearls, not backing down, and when Chuck Todd asks them some really inane, stupid questions on Meet the Press, they don't back down. They stay completely committed. Sure, there'll be a few Lipinski that break off, and they'll get a lot of attention for doing so. But Democrats as a whole remaining committed to the importance of an impeachment process and inquiry into this president, imagine what might be possible. And this leads us to, I think, one of the biggest misreads of Democratic Party leadership right now. And from what I can tell, this is not just in the majority leadership in the House. This is also something within the circles of the DNC and the electoral committees of DCCC. And I'm not expert enough to claim absolute certainty on which is going to become the reality. But I do know that Democrats have latched on to a perceived reality that at least has a 50% chance of being a misread. And that misread, I think, is the effect in the end, DOA impeachment inquiry could have on Democrats' electoral chances in not only 2020, but 2022. Democrats, I think, have already convinced themselves that unless an impeachment inquiry could lead to an impeachment trial in the Senate in which the president is impeached, that it's going to end up backfiring on them. It's a purely cynical and political decision. They know there's enough evidence now to at least call for an inquiry. That's only going to be more evident if they get Mueller and McGahn to testify, which it looks like Mueller at least is going to. Soon, maybe. And any one of the House's own investigations could lead them down the same road. In fact, it's likely they will. And Democrats seem to have boxed themselves once again into this position of just responding to where public opinion is at. And it's ahistorical to a large extent. Polls right now do show that Americans at large don't favor an impeachment battle. And of course, that includes what is, in the end, an unchangeable level of support from Trump among his own base. But you're not changing that anyway. So a lot of Democratic lawmakers are buying into this, saying that, and it's true, that's why it's easy to buy into. Polls do show that a lot of Americans, the majority, don't favor an impeachment battle. Democrats then extrapolate from that, I think, two wrong lessons. One, they extract from that fact that, well, impeachment inquiry would just make it hard for us to talk about other things. And obviously, if this is where Americans are at, they want us to talk about other things. And I do think that is true. I think they're wrong to assume that House Democrats couldn't embark on an impeachment inquiry while as candidates in their home districts and as candidates, even themselves, impeachment inquiry panel members themselves could talk about those other things. I think it's possible to do both. I think the idea that an impeachment inquiry would suck up all, it's going to suck up a lot of air in the room, but the idea that it would suck up all of the air in the room is foolish. We've never seen that actually happen. It does for a time, and it can for weeks at a time. But overall, in a lengthy campaign this far out from Election Day, I think you'll be fine on talking about all of the other things. I think candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Harris are going to make it impossible to talk only about impeachment. And so that's Democrats underselling their own bench on the presidential election. But there's more. Democrats have cited, and I've heard this mainly from Democratic lawmakers, saying that we shouldn't be considering even an impeachment inquiry because it would just kill Democrats in 2020, down ticket and for the White House. I think that's wrong. And I think the biggest reason that's a misread is that they're looking at how Republicans fared, the fallout, if you will, from Clinton's impeachment in 1998. And it's true. House Republicans performed very poorly in the midterm polls that were in the middle of Clinton's impeachment. Clinton had pretty high approval rating with the public at the time. That's one thing they're forgetting. And that stayed until he left office. Actually, he left office with an unusually high approval rating. And so Democrats are looking at that and saying, well, the public hated what Republicans did to Clinton. There actually is no evidence of that. There's evidence it didn't change their mind about Clinton. And there's evidence that Republicans didn't excite voters about their own candidates in the midterm that took place midway through their impeachment charade. All of that evidence exists. But the only evidence you have as to how the public judged Republicans, while not buying into their narrative that Clinton was awful, 2 years later, 2 years after Clinton impeachment trial is all done, he survived a Senate impeachment trial. 2 years after that, Republicans won the presidency. And if you remember, Bush, quote unquote, won, I should say. Even if you believe the Supreme Court handed it to Bush in 2000, you have to acknowledge that that was a damn close race. And so it's really hard to say that the public judged Republicans for what was clearly at the time a cynical partisan ploy to tarnish a very popular president. None of that will be true with Trump. None of that. This is not going to look. Republicans will try their damnedest to make this look like a cynical partisan ploy. It will not work because the man in the White House is so suspicious. There's something about him, right? Also, the impeachment inquiry is going to reveal over and over and over some pretty stunning things. So, 2 years after supposedly the public judges Republicans for the Clinton impeachment charade or circus or whatever you want to call it, Republicans do pretty well, actually. And Bush made it a big part of, well, probably shouldn't say Bush. The Republican Party made it a big part of their campaign in 2000, the quote morals of the Democratic Party. It was a giant foundation of their presidential campaign and a lot of down ticket races. And there's another example. The impeachment overhang, as political scientists call it, in 1976. Incumbent party loses to Jimmy Carter. And obviously, this is right after one of the biggest scandals in American history, even though in hindsight and in contrast with Trump, another thing that shouldn't be forgotten by Democrats, it actually wasn't that big of a scandal in contrast with things we already know about the Trump administration. At least originally. 2 years after Nixon leaves office, which again is just weeks after the House Impeachment Inquiry Committee publishes their findings that should at that point lead to a Senate vote to make a decision on an impeachment trial, Nixon bails just 2 weeks after that report is out. Carter wins the White House and does so on kind of an anti-Washington mood. One of Carter's most successful campaign slogans, he had a few, was "We just want the truth again." So that's kind of a contradictory example, right? Of all the conventional wisdom that you're hearing. And there are contradictory examples to my own examples, to be fair, in American politics throughout. Pelosi was around during the impeachment shenanigans of the 90s. And she could not be unaware of the overriding questions here, whether the actions so far of President Trump demand an impeachment inquiry. There's a constitutional bar there to be set. I think it's pretty clear they do. And I think a lot of presidential candidates have seen that too, and I think bravely made it part of their campaign. It could come back to hurt. Could have been something that hurt them. It didn't. That should also be a tell for Nancy Pelosi and House leadership. The Democratic candidates for the presidential race have only seen excitement bubble up for their calls for an impeachment inquiry. So that should alleviate any concerns of where the base is at. Also, understanding that you're going to go into this election in 2020 competing to some extent on base excitement, because Trump's going to have it. I know there's a rational and reasonable fear that Trump will have more of it under an impeachment inquiry. I really don't know how he could have more. And so I think the biggest risk for Democrats heading into 2020 isn't the fact that down ticket candidates might be hurt. I don't think that's going to be the case. It's not going to be that they have a hard time communicating other policy ideas. The candidates will take care of that. Elizabeth Warren, I think, has shown them how to do it already. And so the only valid concern at this point, really, is do we have a justification? Is the demand for an impeachment inquiry there? And is the public with us on this? And back to that idea, no, right now, the public isn't with you on this. They weren't when the impeachment proceedings against Nixon began. But back to this more broad concept that encapsulates Democratic candidates in red states, blue states, swing states, the Democratic Party at large on policy debates, from tax policy to the asinine government shutdowns while Republicans were at the wheel, to the strange hijacking of Congress by the Freedom Caucus under Boehner and then Ryan's speakerships. You can look at all of this and you can see that no matter how stupid what was being proposed might have been, Republicans didn't pay for that stupidity because they did a much better job of communicating to their base the stupid idea and communicating to the public at large that, stupid or not, they were going to run with it and get the sucker done. Democrats have not been able to do the same thing. Back to Hanisch's essay, The Personal is Political. This ties in with almost everything I've talked about since starting this whole Beating Trump series, which, by the way, thanks to Jeff and crew for letting me expand this into a full podcast here under the Left Show umbrella. But going way back to December and some of the first episodes of Beating Trump, this has been something that has been so obvious to me and has been for a long time, that Democrats have been so horrible for a generation, since Reagan, let's say, at they're great at explaining their ideas. Remember 2010, 11, this whole Obamacare, Affordable Care Act thing? There was such confidence among Democrats supportive of the bill and the whole effort at large, to so much confidence that if we just get out and explain how this will work to the public, they'll love it. Now, 10 years later, that ends up being the case, but my hell, it took that 10 years because Republicans got the best of them. Republicans didn't have an alternative. Republicans had nothing but bullshit and anger. But they didn't pay for that. In fact, more often than not, they won with that. Now, I'm not advocating the same for Democrats. I'm not advocating that Democrats become as absolutely ignorant as the Republican Party and the majority of its candidates have become, to the point where they can't even safely stake out ground confidently and proudly agreeing with science. No party should be proud of that. No party should pat themselves on the back for winning on that. In fact, they should be ashamed of themselves and what they've done to the overall dumbening of the electorate. So I'm not advocating the Democrats do the same. But I'm wishing and hoping that for a second, like Carol Hanisch did in trying to analyze why this fracturing was happening inside the feminist movement in the late 60s. Now, Hanisch doesn't come to the conclusion. She throws out these possibilities that the less political, the apolitical, as she calls them, the people who would describe themselves as not political, maybe it's not that they disagree with what the movement activists were asking for. Maybe it's not that they disagree with where the political factions are currently staking out ground. Maybe what it is that we haven't communicated well enough as a movement, as a party, even as an individual campaign, why what we're asking for or what we plan to do is really damn important. And if there's one thing I hope Democrats discover before the campaigns really get underway early next year, it's that. If there's one thing that I hope Democrats will attach to themselves to when it comes to this decision I still think they're going to be forced to make in the coming weeks on impeachment, that they'll at least entertain the possibility that Democrats not only have the option to change public opinion through action, but also survive a non-changed public opinion issue by issue through action. Their own base right now wants nothing less than they want the status quo. There's absolutely no other way to describe the political climate. And Democrats aren't going to be able to convince anyone they're going to change the status quo if they're not going to take clear and decisive action. Next week on the show, for God's sake, could somebody run for Senate? Thanks for listening.